Welcome. This is Janet Schwartz, broadcasting from Southern Indiana. Welcome to the show tonight. And if you're a first-time listener, we're so glad that you called in or that you're listening on your laptop, and we appreciate that very much. Tonight's topics will be Irene Morgan, Ella Baker, Bayard Rustin, and we're going to talk about the Congress of Racial Equality. My guest today is Sandy Norris, and Sandy, could you please tell us where you're calling from and a little bit about yourself? Go ahead.
Okay, my name is Sandy, and I'm calling from Ohio, and professionally I'm an accountant, and I have been for 30 years, but my passion is learning about our people and the contributions that we've made, and bringing some of those people back to life that history has overlooked and not given us the full credit for the contributions that we've made, not only in America, but globally. So I'm very into African-American history, African history, and just people of color history, what we've done, because we've been so abused and so maligned over the years. And it's time for us to take our rightful place and teach each other, each one, as they all say, so that what you know, you can share with me, and what I know, I can share with you. And that's basically what I'm about.
Thank you, Sandy. I have to ask, if you don't mind, where exactly in Ohio are you? Because a lot of my relatives live in Ohio. Can you tell me where exactly in Ohio that you're at?
I'm in Youngstown.
I'm sorry.
I'm in Youngstown.
You didn't quite come
Youngstown.
Through. Youngstown, okay. Okay. Now, my relatives are all from the northwest part of Ohio, so I hope you don't mind. I had to ask.
No, I don't mind.
So, okay, great. We're going to have fun tonight. And all of you out there, we're going to have fun and call in, all right? Call us at 845-241-9985, and we'll be right back with a word from a word with our sponsors, and then we'll be ready for discussion. And again, in the meantime, call us at 845-241-9985.
You can find Let's Do It Radio on the homepage of Do It All in the Mall. Come join us and listen to Let's Do It Radio as you're shopping the first online mall with over 5,000 stores for all your holiday shopping needs. Yes, Do It All in the Mall has its own radio station, and you can listen to us as you shop. So shop with us, listen to us, and talk with us at doitallinthemall.com.
Hello, everybody. Yes, this is Barack Obama, and I'm here to encourage each and every one of you to shop at doitallinthemall.com. This website will make a difference in our communities and in our lives. I encourage you to do all your shopping at doitallinthemall.com. Let's start making a difference today. Support your people by doing something you are ready to do. It's just where you shop, and that is important, and that matters. Keep the wealth in our communities. Shop doitallinthemall.com. And thank you very much.
All right. Call us, 845-241-9985. We'd love to hear from you as we talk. You can either listen or just listen or add to the conversation. We would love it. Now, we have a couple clips coming up here. And we're going to first talk about a woman named Irene Morgan. And the first clip is called Before Rosa Parks, The Life of Irene Morgan in just over a minute. And also, the second clip is about the highway marker that was unveiled to honor Gloucester civil rights hero Irene Morgan. So let's go ahead and listen to the clips.
Born into a Seventh-day Adventist home on April 9, exactly a century ago, Irene Morgan's defining moment was in July 1944 when she was a passenger on a Greyhound bus traveling from Hayes, Virginia to Baltimore, Maryland. When the bus became crowded, Morgan, who was recovering from a miscarriage, refused to give up her seat for a white man when told by the conductor to do so. Morgan was violently removed from the bus by a local sheriff, jailed, and fined. Her case, Morgan v. Virginia, championed by legendary attorney Thurgood Marshall, was heard by the U.S. Supreme Court, which on June 3, 1946, ruled in favor of Morgan, striking down the Virginia law requiring racial segregation on commercial interstate buses. In 2001, Morgan was awarded the Presidential Citizens Medal by President Bill Clinton, the citation reading, quote, "When Irene Morgan boarded a bus for Baltimore in the summer of 1944, she took the first step on a journey that would change America forever."
Ten on Your Side is celebrating Black History Month through our Hidden History series. And all month, we've been sharing stories that aren't always taught in school.
Yeah, we know about Rosa Parks, but before Rosa refused to give up her seat, Irene Morgan did, and she was from Gloucester. Earlier this month, the community came together to unveil a historical marker in her honor, and Kara Dixon was there to capture it all, and she joins us now.
Yeah, that's right. And did you know that Virginia has one of the oldest historical highway programs in the country? Mm. Well, it started in 1927, and the program says within the first 50 years, they only had 5 markers highlighting Black achievements. Now they're above 350, and only a select few people have 2 markers. One of them was Gloucester's Irene Morgan, whose simple refusal forged its own path during the Civil Rights Movement. Although the years have trickled by, the lasting impact of one woman still remains as strong as ever.
There's another marker in Saluda, but this is where her story began.
The story of Irene Morgan, who boarded a Greyhound bus here at this location in 1944. 76 years later, her family, friends, and the Gloucester community showed up to unveil her highway marker.
Her life is an example of just one person taking a stand can make a difference to affect an entire country.
Morgan, who had just suffered a miscarriage, boarded the bus after a visit to her mother's. She was on her way to Baltimore to get clearance from her doctor to work for the war efforts. Morgan was already in the back of the bus when she was told to give up her seat.
What really angered her was that there was a woman, a mother, sitting next to her with an infant in her hand, and she was told to give up her seat as well, and she was really outraged by this.
She said no and was arrested. Her case, which was represented by the legendary Thurgood Marshall, made its way to the Supreme Court. In 1946, they ruled desegregation for interstate bus travel.
So many people were inspired by what she did. You know, it was just this one woman who wasn't even, 5'6", standing up against the sheriff who's threatening to beat her, and just not bowing down, not giving in.
It's a sentiment those here hope will help to continue her legacy of making things right in this world.
All kinds of injustice, happening around us, and it's really important for us to stand up.
Mm-hmm. Because the struggle will always continue.
A struggle that takes just one brave soul to say no when they need to. And President Clinton awarded Morgan the Presidential Citizens Award in 2000. She passed away in 2007. Her family says she was just a remarkable woman overall, and that included inviting homeless people to Thanksgiving dinners, housing them, and helping to desegregate schools. I'm Kara Dixon, 10 on Your Side.
All right. We have heard the first clip about Irene Morgan, and what we want to do first of all is I want to give you a little more detail about what she did. She couldn't even buy a ticket from the regular window when she was at Hayes grocery store to board that Greyhound bus. She had to buy her ticket from the colored window, so even that was segregated when she wanted to ride the Greyhound bus. She sat in the back of the bus, as the clip told us, for colored people. And again, the officer asked, actually the bus driver asked her to move. And when she refused, they proceeded to the next town to have her arrested. Now, one of the things that they didn't tell you and is how bold this woman was, because it says when the officer gave Morgan an arrest warrant, she tore it up in his face. When the officer tried to forcibly remove her, she kicked him in the groin. That's pretty bold. Other officers responded and removed Morgan from the bus. And then she was arrested for violating the Virginia's Jim Crow laws. And as the clips told us about the case Irene Morgan versus the Commonwealth of Virginia, she actually won that in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, helped by Thurgood Marshall, which we talked about last time we had the show. And I want to share just a few more tidbits here before we start our discussion. In 1945, the Morgan family moved to New York City, and in 1948, at the age of 32, her husband died, leaving her alone with two young children. So here she has the experience of a single mom until about a year later she married a dry cleaning business owner, Stanley Kirkcaldy. Together, they owned and operated house cleaning and child care businesses in Queens. Now, listen to what she accomplished later on. In 1981, okay, this event, the first event we talked about occurred in 1944 when she's arrested. And we fast forward to 1981, Morgan won a college scholarship from a radio contest. And 4 years later, in 1985, at the age of 68, she earned her bachelor's degree in communications from St. John's University. 5 years later, in 1990, at the age of 72, she received her master's degree in urban studies from Queens College. They also made an episode on Point of View on PBS in 1995 about her, entitled You Don't Have to Ride Jim Crow, and that featured her. In 2000, she was honored by the Gloucester City, Virginia, during its 350th anniversary, and as we heard in the clip, and 1 year later, President Bill Clinton awarded her the Presidential Citizens Medal. In 2010, she was inducted into Maryland Women's Hall of Fame. So we have a very strong woman here, wasn't afraid to stand up to the police officer, as we heard, and made a name for herself as a result of that, and even went on later in life to earn college degrees to make an impact on the world around here. So, you know, here we have Irene Morgan, and they have unveiled a marker for her where it all started. So, Sandy, what kind of comments do you have about this?
Well, what I'd like to say is that she was a very, very strong woman and very determined and knew exactly what she wanted to do, and that she was smart enough to consult with attorneys to appeal her conviction. And she went to the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, who took up her case. And she was represented by William Hayes, who was the former governor of the U.S. Virgin Islands, and he was later a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. And then Thurgood Marshall, the of NAACP, took her case, and it was Irene Morgan versus the Commonwealth of Virginia, and it was appealed to the United States Supreme Court, which of course she won. One of the things that bothers me, however, is that although she won her case, neither Virginia nor other states observed the ruling, and it was not enforced for decades. So you can get what you ask for, but that still doesn't mean that the powers that be are going to give you even what the Supreme Court says you're allowed to have, because the people that didn't want to enforce it did not enforce it for decades. But she continued to fight. She continued to live her life. She continued to go on to school. She tried her best to reconcile. And she inspired the 1947 Journey of Reconciliation during 16 activists from the Chicago-based Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE, however you want to say that. They rode on interstate buses through the Upper South to test the enforcement of the Supreme Court's ruling. And the activists divided themselves from the Interstate Greyhound and the Trailways bus line. And they usually placed an interracial pair in the white area of the bus just to upset the driver and the other people who were riding on the bus, the other passengers. Because when you have an interracial couple, what do you do? You cannot say you can't sit with your wife or you can't sit with your husband. So they had to leave them alone. And so they were disguised as ordinary passengers, but they weren't. They were people who were actually taking notes and making memorandums to enforce that case by going as interracial couples. So I thought that that was very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. We're actually going to talk about the journey of reconciliation in the next show. So, and I look forward to that. And I, just a little bit ahead of time here, the when those people who went on that journey got arrested, the judge, one of the judges, was more angry at the white people than the blacks and gave the white people a stronger sentence. And he said to them, to the whites, he said, "You bring your Jews and your N-words down here to try to get us to change our ways, and you're not going to do it." I mean, that was the kind of thing they faced on the journey of reconciliation. But again, we're going to talk about that more in the next show in 2 weeks. Anyone else on the line who would like to make a comment or a question? We have at least 10 people I know listening in. Anyone else have any comments? All right. Well, we're going to be back with a word from our sponsors. And again, call us 845-241-9985. Let's go ahead and have a word from our sponsors.
Let's Do It Radio at doitallinthemall.com. We're online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and that includes holidays.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot. believe it. Freedom can arrest. We who believe in freedom can arrest. Come on, sing now. We who believe in freedom can arrest. We who believe in freedom can
We just heard Ella's song, sung by the Resistance Revival Chorus. And before we go on to the clips about Ella Baker, that song was patterned after, actually it was almost word for word, for one of her sayings, one of her quotes that I was going to read later, but let's go ahead and read it. She said, until the killing of black men, black mothers' sons, becomes as important to the rest of the country as the killing of a white mother's son. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until this happens. So that song was word for word for one of her quotes. We're going to listen to two clips of Ella Baker, and the cool thing is the second clip is actually her speaking. So let's go ahead and listen to the first clip called Women You Should Know, and then the second clip is called Making the Struggle Every Day.
Friends, brothers, and sisters in the struggle for human dignity and freedom, I am here to represent the struggle that has gone on for 300 or more years.
Ella Josephine Baker was known as the backbone of the civil rights movement. Born in 1903 in Littleton, North Carolina, her rural community had seen racial injustice and poverty throughout the Great Depression. Deeply rooted in family, Ella's grandmother told her stories about the injustices of slavery. She was taught the importance of giving to those in need, standing up for what you believe, and the value of education. Ella graduated valedictorian of Shaw University in Raleigh in 1927 and moved to Harlem, New York. In the height of the Harlem Renaissance, Ella was introduced to activism and worked towards social improvement. By the late 1930s, she helped to form the Young Negroes Cooperative League, created to pool community resources for economic empowerment. She joined the NAACP and in 1940 became its first field secretary and later its national director of branches. Ella led by listening and had a special gift of inspiring people to believe they could make a change. It was her grassroots leadership that caused her to part ways with the bureaucratic approach of the NAACP in 1955. She moved to Montgomery, Alabama after the major bus boycott and formed In Friendship, a fundraising organization for the movement in the South. Ella would join the newly formed Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC, led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1957 and serve as its director. She was a master at group dynamics, responding to human emotions and the need for black people to be treated with dignity. Although Ella would frame most of the organization's protest campaigns and identify community leaders, she was challenged by the top-down, male-dominated norms of the period. She said, "My theory is strong people don't need strong leaders." Inspired by college students taking a stand by sitting down in 1960 in Greensboro, North Carolina, she left to help young people organize a conference at Shaw University. In that weekend meeting, the students would form the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, one of the most impactful direct action civil rights organizations in the movement.
Ella would teach techniques and advise SNCC in joining with other youth-led organizations to protest segregation through sit-ins across the Southeast in 1960, through the Freedom Rides in 1961, and Freedom Summer of 1964. While Baker did not gain prominence in some of the mainstream media, she remained an influential leader, and her work earned her the nickname Fundi, which is Swahili for a person who teaches the next generation. On her 83rd birthday, Ella died in New York, December the 13th, 1986. Women You Should Know, Ella Baker.
Brothers and sisters in the struggle for human dignity and freedom, I am here to represent the struggle that has gone on for 300 or more years, a struggle to be recognized as citizens in a country in which we were born. I have had about 40 or 50 years of struggle ever since a little boy on the streets of Norfolk called me a nigger. I struck him back. And then I had to learn. I had to learn that hitting back with my fist one individual was not enough. It takes organization. It takes dedication. It takes the willingness to stand by and do what has to be done when it has to be done. A nice gathering like today is not enough. You have to go back and reach out to your neighbors who don't speak to you. And you have to reach out to your friends who think they are making it good, and get them to understand that they, as well as you and I, cannot be free in America or anywhere else where there is capitalism and imperialism until we can get people to recognize that they themselves have to make the struggle and have to make the fight for freedom every day in the year, every year, until they win it. Thank you.
Ella Baker. Here's a woman who started out her life listening to her grandmother's story of slavery. Her grandmother was a slave, and her grandmother had been whipped for not marrying a man chosen for her by the slave owner. So those are the kind of stories that Ella Baker grew up with. And I mean, what a priceless gift to be able to sit there and have a grandmother who went through all of that and to be able to be influenced by that. And I mean, how forward that is to form the Young Negroes Cooperatively in 1930. I mean, think of 1930 and what was going on back then towards African Americans. Her nickname Fundi, F-U-N-D-I, as the clip said, is a Swahili word meaning a person who teaches a craft to the next generation. And we do have another quote from her before we take the calls here. She did a lot of work in the background. She was active in the young people having their sit-ins. She was active with Martin Luther King Jr. She was active in a lot of organizations. And one of her quotes here is this. She says, "You didn't see me on television. You didn't see news stories about me. The kind of role that I tried to play was to pick up pieces or put together pieces out of which I hoped organization might come. My theory is strong people don't need strong leaders. Now, we have a caller on the line. The last four digits of the phone number are 5143. If you are there, 5143, could you tell us who you are and where you're calling from? 5143. Do we have caller 5143? Okay. Well, if 5143 wants to join in at some point, you're more than welcome to. So she had a great, she had her, you know, when I think of her, she just had her hand in many pies. She had her hand in many organizations here. I mean, what a woman to be able to have that kind of passion to be so involved in just content to just be in the background, like she said. You know, you didn't see me in the news. You didn't see me out there in the front, but I believe that strong people don't need strong leaders. So, Sandy, give us some of your thoughts on all this.
Okay, one of the things that impressed me is that she was a grassroots-type person and didn't want her name out there with everyone else's because but she did work with some very notable people like W.E.B. Du Bois, Thurgood Marshall, Athol Brandolph, and as you said, Martin Luther King. And she also mentored many emerging activists such as Diane Nash, Stokely Carmichael, and Bob Moses as leaders in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC. She was just a woman who didn't want the spotlight, but everything that she did put her in the spotlight, even regardless of the fact that she just wanted to be humble and in the background. She just had that type of personality, and she was very influential in the civil rights movement. She's known for her critiques of both racism and sexism in the civil rights movement.
Those are some great points. I appreciate you sharing that. That's a lot of information for everyone out there to hang on to and to learn about someone that they don't know about here, Ella Baker. One of her other quotes is, she says, one of the things that has to be faced is the process of waiting to change the system. How much we have got to do to find out who we are, where we have come from, and where we are going. Ella Baker. Again, we have caller 5143 on the line. Caller 5143, last four digits of the phone number. If you're with us, could you tell us who you are and where you're calling from? Okay. Call us at 845-241-9985. We will be right back with a poem from Freedom Day. Again, call us 845-241-9985. We'll be right back.
Freedom matters. It lives and breathes in our bodies, unleashed as dancing breath, air and life loving itself in defiance of death. Freedom matters, free like deep belly laughter spilling from children's teeth, from Robben Island to Limpopo, the sound of joy taking flight and filling the streets. Freedom matters, loud like vuvuzela, like mirupa, like the roar of a million or more as our national team score. Freedom, wild like stampedes across Kukuza, like stretches of savanna, like unstoppable Cape winds and those homegrown high-felt thunderstorms. Freedom, finally, like 25 years ago, a day of long queues and heavy hopes. Marking X on the ballot was how this great democracy was born. Freedom wise, like saving for a rainy day, like changing our minds, valuing growth and learning from our mistakes. Freedom matters, beautiful, like this piece of earth we call home for me and you and you and you, each one human in all of our hues. Freedom matters, true. Like the blood in our veins that runs red, green, black, white, yellow, and blue. Freedom to be, freedom to do, freedom to love, freedom to move, freedom to continue our story.
Sex is obscene. We've got it twisted in this lucid dream. Baptizing boundaries, schooled in sin, divided by difference, sexuality and skin. Oh, so we can hate each other and fear each other. We can build these walls between each other, baby, blow by blow and brick by brick. Keep yourself locked in, yourself locked in. Yeah, we can hate each other and fear each other. We can build these walls between each other, baby, blow by blow and brick by brick. Keep yourself locked in, yourself locked. Oh, maybe we should love
We just heard that song called Holy War by Alicia Keys. Call us, 845-241-9985. The next person we're going to talk about worked with Ella Baker, and we're going to talk about Bayard Rustin. The next clip that we're going to listen to is called Why a Gay Black Civil Rights Hero Opposed Affirmative Action. Let's go ahead and listen to that clip.
In the past few years, I have seen all too many blacks fall into the trap of calling any white person who disagrees with them a racist.
Now that may sound like a criticism of today's race politics, but it was actually written 50 years ago by civil rights leader Bayard Rustin.
Mr. Bayard Rustin!
Bayard was Martin Luther King's collaborator and the chief organizer of the 1963 March on Washington.
And the right to vote! What do you say?
Years before Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on a bus, Bayard was arrested and beaten by police for doing the same thing. One of 24 times he'd be arrested throughout his life.
In fact, he was arrested right here at the World's Fair in New York City while demonstrating peacefully for equality.
If you've been paying attention, you may have seen Bayard popping up a bit this Black History Month.
Bayard Rustin was one of the most important figures.
I think that Bayard Rustin is one of the people who's kind of almost criminally under-recognized.
It's heartening to see Bayard entering the public consciousness.
A civil rights hero was almost erased from history all because of homophobia.
But these portrayals mostly focus on his identity.
He's black, gay, socialist pacifist, right? Like, he's actually America's worst nightmare.
He was openly gay, he was a socialist, he was an organizer. That's great, but what's missing are his actual ideas. And why is that? Well, his intersectional credentials fit the spirit of modern activism, but his ideas, not so much.
The problem can never be stated in terms of black and white.
The point of Black History Month is to give a fuller account of history, unflinching and honest. If we cherry-pick our heroes, and then cherry-pick even smaller parts of their legacy to match our pre-existing beliefs, we are merely paying lip service to that mission.
If a bigot says to me, the sun is shining. If the sun is shining, I say, yes, the sun is shining. Because I want to tell the truth.
I'm a writer and race commentator, and Bayard Rustin holds a special place in my heart. I've lost count of the times I've had a seemingly original thought about race relations, only to realize that Bayard beat me to the punch half a century ago. He opposed affirmative action. He opposed reparations for slavery. And he even opposed the concept of African American studies as a unique discipline. Take the recent blackface scandals. In 1951, Bayard argued against banning blackface minstrel shows. He believed that the very existence of minority groups depends on the freedom of expression and civil liberty. Imagine that in 2019. Bayard saw trouble in the new direction of black activism in the 1960s. He worried that the movement was prioritizing divisive displays of righteous anger over the inclusive coalition building that had led to successful civil rights reforms.
Today I see the same divisiveness on display in the tendency to take issues that affect Americans of all colors, whether police violence, criminal justice policy, or education reform, and frame them in exclusively racial terms.
Bayard's commitment to humanity over racial politics ensured that he would be attacked from all sides.
Sir, I'm a Tom, and I'm prepared to be a Tom where I can save women and children from being shot down in the street, and if you're not, you're nothing but a fool.
Bayard was a lifelong socialist, a friend of the labor movement. Most people associate socialism with the liberal left, and therefore progressive racial politics. But Bayard had true socialist convictions.
No economic or social order has ever been developed on the basis of color. It must be developed on the basis of class.
Which led him to oppose affirmative action and reparations, instead advocating a federal jobs guarantee, a higher minimum wage, and universal health care.
Bayard criticized another trend that's on the rise today. He called it white liberal syndrome.
This syndrome causes white liberals to expect less from blacks out of a desire to signal their awareness of racism. A recent study from the Yale School of Management found that white liberals use simpler words when communicating with a person they assume is black rather than white. Conservatives, on the other hand, showed no racial bias.
Another symptom of white liberal syndrome? The belief that white people have no authority to talk about race issues.
Byard saw this attitude as another way in which whites exploited blacks. Not for money or for power in this case, but for moral absolution. Or as he put it, Negroes have been used and exploited in many ways by white Americans, but it is only recently that they have been asked to satisfy the masochistic craving of disenchanted liberals for flagellation and rejection. A full account of Byard Rustin means valorizing him not only as a black man or a gay man, but also as an intellectual. Reducing Byard to an intersectional prop is a symptom of a much larger problem. Our failure as a nation to converge around a set of values that don't depend on our own particular identities. Byard said it best. My activism did not spring from my being gay, or for that matter, from my being black. Rather, it is rooted fundamentally in my Quaker upbringing and the values that were instilled in me by my grandparents who reared me. Those values are based on the concept of a single human family and the belief that all members of that family are equal. Adhering to those values has meant making a stand against injustice to the best of my ability whenever and wherever it occurs.
Byard Rustin, I want to add a few details to what we just heard. We had, before the Montgomery bus boycott, he helped organize a group called, quote, In Friendship. This was amongst Baker, George Lawrence, Stanley Levinson of the American Jewish Congress, and some other labor leaders. Now, this group, In Friendship, provided material and legal assistance to those being evicted from their tenant farms and households in Clarendon County, Yazoo, and other places. Rustin became the head of the AFL-CIO's A. Philip Randolph Institute, which promoted the integration of formerly all-white unions and promoted the unionization of African Americans. Now, during the 1970s and 1980s, Rustin served on many humanitarian missions, such as aiding refugees from communist Vietnam and Cambodia. At the time of his death, he was on a humanitarian mission in Haiti. Now, we know that he was a gay man, and due to criticism over his sexuality, he usually acted as an influential advisor behind the scenes to civil rights leaders. In the 1980s, he became a public advocate on behalf of gay causes, speaking at events as an activist and supporter of human rights. And then later on in life, while still devoted to securing workers' rights, Rustin joined other union leaders in aligning with ideological neoconservatism. And after his death, President Ronald Reagan praised him. On November 20th, 2013, President Barack Obama posthumously awarded Rustin the Presidential Medal of Freedom. So a lot to unpack about Byard Rustin and about his uniqueness. I'm struck by how his uniqueness set him apart from everyone else in the movement and the fact that he was involved in so many things, as was Ella Baker. So, Sandy, tell us what you think about what we just heard, or give us some of your comments on that.
Okay, when I was studying about him and doing some reading to prepare for this evening, I learned about him that I really didn't know. He met the young civil rights leader, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., in the 50s, and he began working with him as an advisor and a strategist in 55. And he taught King about Gandhi's philosophy of nonviolent resistance and advised him on the tactics of civil disobedience. He assisted him with the boycott of segregated buses in Montgomery, Alabama in 1956. And most famously, he was a key figure in the organization of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, at which King delivered his legendary I Have a Dream speech on August 28, And then in 65, Rustin and Randolph co-founded the A. Philip Randolph Institute, which was a labor organization for African-American trade union members. And he continued his work with the civil rights and peace movement and was making demand as any of the other leaders of the time. And he really suffered a lot because of his gayness, and he was punished several times for his beliefs. During the war, he was jailed for 2 years when he refused to register for the draft. And when he took part in protests against the segregated public transit system in 1947, he was arrested in North Carolina and sentenced to work on a chain gang. In 1953, he was arrested on a charge for being publicly engaging in a homosexual activity and was sent to jail for 6 years. However, he continued to live as an openly gay man. So I know that it's hard enough to be a person of color in America. So to be a gay person of America, he had it probably worse than most people would, but he didn't give up. He was an organizer of human rights protests, and he did a lot of things for the African Americans and for the civil rights movement. So he was much more important than I even knew that he was before I started studying about him. And he attended Wilberforce University in Ohio, which, of course, me being from Ohio, that put my little ears up. Mm-hmm. And he went to the Cheney University in Pennsylvania, and they were both historically black schools. So he was a very influential person.
Yeah. I'm just so struck, just listening to everything that you had to add. I'm just struck by his involvement, the depth of his involvement and the depth of himself as a person is what strikes me, and all of the things that he was working at behind the scenes that we don't know about. And again, Sandy, I'm learning just as much about him as you are. When I research these great leaders, I'm thinking, why don't we know about these people, and why aren't they being taught in the schools? They need to be. And I'm looking forward to the time when history is a full, more complete history, not just black history and not just white history, but a complete, you know, black and white, and that it covers all aspects, that we have a curriculum that's balanced out, with an emphasis on look at these people that we didn't know about. Anyone else on the line? Oh, go ahead. Yeah. Anyone else on the line? Go ahead. I'm sorry. I keep cutting you off. Go ahead.
Okay. There was just one other thing that I wanted to add. He was raised by his grandparents, but he discovered in adolescence that the woman that he thought was his sibling, whose name was Florence, was in fact his mother, who had
been
with a Western immigrant, Archie Hopkins. So he was raised by his grandparents, but he thought they were his parents up until he was in adolescence.
I remember reading about that his so-called sister was 16 years old, and he just didn't realize that that was his mother. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I remember reading about that, and what a challenge that had to be. But look at the greatness that came out of it, that he was raised by such an influential people. He said his convictions were based upon his Quaker upbringing, where you see everyone as part of a big family, and that all members of the family are equal.
Right.
So, okay, call us if you're out there, 845-241-9985. We're learning a lot tonight. I love talking about all these people. The last section we're going to dedicate to is to an entity called the Congress of Racial Equality. And we're going to listen to a clip called Fighting Discrimination and Segregation, the Congress of Racial Equality, Civil Rights in the U.S. So let's go ahead and listen to that clip.
Academy for Social Change presents the Congress of Racial Equality. In 1942, a group of students from Chicago broke off from the pacifist civil rights group Fellowship of Reconciliation to form their own organization. These students were inspired by the pacifist Mahatma Gandhi and his use of nonviolent protest to fight inequality. The students called their organization the Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE. The Congress of Racial Equality was one of the leading activist organizations at the beginning of the civil rights movement. Founded by an interracial group of students in 1942, CORE sought to fight racial discrimination through nonviolent direct action advocacy. It was a crucial player in the Freedom Rides, Freedom Summer, and 1963 March on Washington. In the late 1960s, CORE shifted from emphasizing pacifism to focusing more on black nationalism and separatism. During its first few years, CORE focused on using nonviolent tactics to challenge segregation in the North. Though it was an interracial group, most members were white and middle class. In 1942, CORE staged one of the first sit-ins in the country at a coffee shop in Chicago. In 1947, it expanded its advocacy to the Upper South by organizing the Journey of Reconciliation, an integrated bus ride through multiple states in the Upper South. Riders wanted to see if law enforcement would respect a 1946 Supreme Court ruling that banned segregation in interstate travel. They encountered little violence, but multiple riders were arrested. In 1955, CORE expanded fully to the South. It trained demonstrators at the Montgomery bus boycott in nonviolent advocacy and began fighting other instances of public segregation in the South. In 1957, Martin Luther King Jr. joined CORE's advisory committee. CORE and King's organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, partnered on several initiatives in the late 1950s, including the Prayer Pilgrimage for Public Schools, which advocated for school integration, and the Voter Education Project, which was a large-scale voter registration project. In 1963, CORE would co-sponsor the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, at which King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech. In 1961, James Farmer became CORE's first black national director. CORE's first black 1961 Freedom Rides, which were inspired by the earlier Journey of Reconciliation. Their Freedom Rides aimed to desegregate interstate transportation, but unlike the Journey of Reconciliation, Freedom Riders traveled into the Deep South. The black and white riders were met with shocking amounts of violence. In Alabama, a bus was firebombed and passengers were viciously attacked. The mob violence and the subsequent lack of response from local and national authorities prompted public outcry. Over the next few years, CORE increased its focus on voter registration. It joined the Council of Federated Organizations, or COFO, which coordinated local and national civil rights groups in Mississippi. COFO ran the 1964 Freedom Summer Project, which got white northern volunteers to help activists register black voters in Mississippi. The project hoped to fight intimidation and discrimination in the voting process and prevent the disenfranchisement of black voters. During Freedom Summer, the KKK killed three volunteers, Andrew Goodman, James Caney, and Michael Schwerner. Their murders gained widespread national attention, especially because Goodman and Schwerner were white. By the mid-1960s, many CORE members were growing disillusioned with nonviolence. The murders of Goodman, Shaney, and Schwerner, along with other violent attacks in the South, contributed to the shift. In 1966, Floyd McKissick replaced Farmer as the national director of CORE. Under McKissick, CORE focused on ideologies of black power and black separatism and reduced the involvement of white members. The assassination of King in 1968 accelerated the shift. McKissick called King the last prince of nonviolence and declared nonviolence a dead philosophy. Roy Innes succeeded McKissick as the national director of CORE. In the first decades of his tenure, he and, by extension, CORE, became increasingly conservative. Under Innes, CORE supported Republican presidents Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush, and was alienated by other civil rights organizations. Innes remains the national director of CORE today. CORE was one of the first organizations to use nonviolent tactics during the American Civil Rights Movement. It organized some of the most important demonstrations of the movement, including the Freedom Rides and Freedom Summer. It brought national attention to discrimination and disenfranchisement of African Americans and increased support for the Civil Rights Movement. CORE's advocacy helped lead to the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, both of which made significant strides in ending legalized discrimination and segregation in American life. Its shift away from pacifism also highlighted the tensions between white moderates and black activists. This tension can be seen today, including in Black Lives Matter protests. White moderates may criticize protesters for property damage or for making what they believe are unreasonable demands, while black activists criticize those moderates for performative activism and not listening to those who are actually oppressed. Now it's your turn to think further. CORE began as an organization made up of mostly white moderates. What might a mostly white organization focused on racial equality overlook? How can a more diverse membership change and improve a group's priorities?
The Congress of Racial Equality, CORE. One thing I wanted to add to this, and there is a documentary called Freedom on My Mind. You can actually Google it and find it online under videos. So if you type in Freedom on My Mind, Google, and hit videos, you should be able to find it online. And they talk about CORE and the summer of 1964, the Freedom Summer, which the murder of the three CORE workers, Michael Schwerner, Andrew Goodman, and James Chaney in Mississippi. And it was interesting to me that when they interviewed people in the South that around the area that they were looking for the car and for the bodies, people didn't believe it. People thought it was just a big joke that CORE was trying to play on them until they actually found the car with the bodies. And they took that car to the 1964 Democratic Convention, Democratic National Convention of 1964. They took that car and actually put it outside the building where that convention was meeting so that people could see, you know, look, this is what's going on. We need a voice here. So CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, had so many things going on. And I'm just impressed with their work starting back in 1942 and going all the way up to today. So, Sandy, what do you want to add to that?
Things that I learned while I was studying was how deeply CORE was involved with education. Because in 1960, the Chicago chapter of CORE began to challenge racial segregation in the Chicago public schools. And by the late 1950s, the Chicago Board of Education's maintenance of the neighborhood school policy resulted in a pattern of racial segregation in the Chicago public system. Predominantly black schools were situated in predominantly black neighborhoods on the south side and west sides of the city, while predominantly white schools were located in predominantly white areas in the north, northwest, and southwest sides of Chicago. And a lot of the segregated schools were overcrowded, and in order to ease overcrowding, the board instituted double shifts at some of the schools, and that meant that students in affected schools attended less than a full day of class. In another measure to alleviate overcrowding at some schools, the board sanctioned the construction of mobile classroom units. And according to CORE, school segregation was a damaging bacteria, a psychological handicap, which fostered a disease generating widespread unemployment and crime in Chicago. So they wrote letters to the Board of Education and to then-Mayor Richard Daley, the Illinois House of Representatives, and the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. And in addition, they attended the school's budget hearings, speaking against segregation and asking for the board to implement transfer plans to desegregate the school. They were successful in July of 1963 after staging a week-long sit-in and protest at the board office in downtown Chicago. So I just found it very interesting that they took such an interest in education that they would focus on a city like Chicago, which has always been a city that has had a lot of problems. But mm-hmm. they were so interested in making sure that those students got a good education that forewent and fought with and for the school to challenge the segregation and the transfer mm-hmm. positions and all those other things. So that impressed me when I learned about that.
Sure. And I was struck when you talked about the school segregation and how they had what I want to put into words like two shifts, where the school day was shortened so that it could be repeated, I guess, twice in the same day. And yeah, that would cut down the amount of schooling that these segregated schools would have. And that I never thought about that and how it would contribute to the crime in the cities. So that was very interesting. I appreciate all your information that you're sharing with us. We have Sharon on the line, Sharon Frazier, and she would like to say something. Sharon, are you there with us?
Yes, I am, ladies. I have enjoyed the knowledge, the learning. I was amazed at the brother who was home in the gay community. Because sometimes I mm-hmm. think people think that the community just came about recently. So it was really shocking to hear someone in that era be a gay person. So that mm-hmm. kind of hit me that, you know, this isn't something that just started. It's been going on in America for a long time. So that was very shocking to me when I was listening to what you were saying. But yes, it was a very good sure. show today. Very much knowledge. Sandra brought it very well with Janet. You guys did really, really good.
Yeah.
Very proud of the knowledge. Very proud. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Okay, I'm Janet Schwartz, and you've been listening to Let's Do It Radio on the homepage of doitallinthemall.com. And Sandy, I just want to give a special thank you to you. You really contributed great to this show tonight. So thank you very much, Sandy.
Oh, you're very welcome. I found it was very knowledgeable for me to find out mm-hmm. the different people and organizations that we were going to be discussing. And so I had to make a lot of notes because I didn't want to forget anything. Mm-hmm.
So I learned a lot myself
just in researching these different things. So I just want to thank you mm-hmm. for the opportunity to educate myself, you know, and get some information mm-hmm. that I never
knew. Uh-huh. Yeah. And I look forward to having you back on the show the next time we're here in 2 weeks. So thank you for being with us. And today at Let's Do It Radio, we're going to leave you with a poem called This Is America, a poetry on racial prejudice and injustice. Let's listen to the poem.
You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say or do at this point will not really matter because your skin color has already confessed to the crime. You have the right to an attorney who will try his hardest to see that justice is served, but a jury of your peers, aka our attorneys, will have him outmatched 12 to 1. If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be provided to you free of charge because he is also on our payroll. Do you understand these rights as they have been read to you? Whoa, 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 don't move. I see you reaching for your 9mm wallet. I see you reaching for your 38 caliber inhaler. Whoa, I said don't move. Stop breathing. You're puffing up your chest. I feel threatened. Stop resisting arrest. Is that a weapon? Lay down. No, 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 no. Face down. No, no, no. Face ground. Bang. Pow. Oops, I did it again. I'm a pop star. No, I'm a pop star. No, I'm a cop star. No, by the time I get back to the precinct, I will be a rock star. Clap for them. I have more trophies with black names on them than BET award winners. Clap for them. I will probably be honored at the NYPD award dinner. Clap for them. They are going to throw me a parade. Clap for them. Because when I clap for them, they go to the grave. Black boys' cries fall on deaf white ears. Black mothers' tears keep graveyard grass green. Black mothers' tears keep graveyard grass green. And black men's bones are the gavel with which judges finalize false convictions. Wake up, black boys. It's time to declare war. I wonder if Trayvon Martin's mother, how she feels that her son is a household name, and he is not a household body. I wonder if Freddie Gray's family can still say grace over their food, even though their prayers could not stop the thief that robbed him of his last breath. I wonder when Tamir Rice died playing cops and robbers, if he still saw the former more innocent than the latter. I wonder if black women feel closer to God because they're steady having to lay to rest their only begotten sons. I wonder if black people's skin got darker because we're closer to the sun, then how many years will it take us to grow bulletproof skin because we're closer to the guns? I wonder.
Come on, baby.
I wonder if black people's skin got darker because we're closer to the sun, how many years it will take us to grow bulletproof skin because we're closer to the guns. I'm tired. I'm tired of going to funerals where babies are being buried in boxes bigger than the ones they used to put their toys in. I'm tired of not being able to say, see you later to my friends. We're steady practicing our goodbye words to each other. I'm tired of not being able to tell my girlfriend, let's wait until we're married. I'm scared she will walk down the aisle and see me in a box before she sees me in a tuxedo. I'm tired. I'm tired. I'm tired. I'm tired because I'm forced to stay woke in a society whose laws are written as lullabies to black people. I'm tired. I'm tired. I wonder if America will be alarmed when she wakes up and sees black folk ain't sleeping no more because the American dream is the African-American nightmare. I'm tired. I'm tired. I'm tired because I'm forced to stay woke. And if I finally go to sleep, I might stay asleep forever.
Believing freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
Believe it. we who